A new biography of Martin Luther King is out. It's the first major work in a generation, and it tries to paint a realistic, nuanced picture of the man, heralded as one of the most pivotal Americans in history. Jonathan Eich is author of King, A Life. Jonathan, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to talk to you.
Why is it important to learn about Dr. King, the flesh and bones man?
I think it's important that we, in general, try not to treat our heroes as if they were mythological figures, because then it's very difficult to relate to them. And in the case of Dr. King in particular, since he became a national holiday almost 40 years ago and a monument on the Mall in Washington, we've seen not just the celebration, but we've seen sort of the watering down of his message boiled down to I have a dream and content of our character. And we've forgotten he was really radical. We've forgotten that he suffered, that he had moments of doubt, moments of depression even. And we don't need our heroes to be perfect. They're more relatable and more meaningful when they're flesh and blood.
You begin your book with a doozy of a tale about his paternal grandmother, Delia King. She and her husband were sharecroppers, early 20th century, the age of Jim Crow. Tell us the story of her fearlessness taking on a white mill owner.
She was ferocious. She was also somebody who would give the little bit of food she had for a neighbor who was worse off. And one day, in fact, she sent her son, Mike King, who would later become Martin Luther King Sr., to deliver a bucket of milk and butter to a neighbor who had a sick cow. And on the way, Mike was attacked and beaten by a white mill owner. And when he got home and said that he'd been beaten up and he had bruises and blood on his face, his mother marched him right back to that mill and confronted the white mill owner and actually beat him, physically attacked the white mill owner and said, "Nobody touches my son." This was Stockbridge, Georgia, around 1910. A really telling incident that Martin Luther King Jr. came from a line of people who were not going to take their mistreatment passively.
Well, King Sr., the daddy, is a preacher at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, although the history of that church connects through his mother's side, and there's new source information in your book about his parents. What did you learn, Jonathan, about them and their influence on their son?
Martin Luther King's parents are really heroic figures, and Martin Luther King Sr. in particular is 12 years old when he walks off the farm with his shoes slung over his shoulder so he doesn't wear them out and makes his way to Atlanta. One of the things I found in my research was an unpublished autobiography of Martin Luther King Sr. Hmm. And one of the things we learn is that he was really most determined to try to find economic stability for his family.
Here is King Sr., a decade after his son was assassinated, reflecting on how he grew up and what he wanted for his kids.
I'm talking about in the woods, sure enough, in the country, sure enough. But I never wanted a child of mine to come the way I did. And I made it possible for them to come differently.
King's mother was the choir director at Ebenezer, and her father was the pastor at Ebenezer. So Alberta King, as well as Martin Luther King Sr., really raised their children with the importance of the Bible's message that all people were equal and that it wasn't just something you preached on Sundays. It was something you had to go out and live and make happen.
And King Jr., he attends Crozer Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania, and then he goes to graduate school at Boston University. And along the way, he declares he's going to vanquish Jim Crow. My goodness, where does that boldness come from?
You know, young M.L. King was really ambitious. This is a kid who snuck into kindergarten a year early, who skipped several grades of middle school. And then by the time he gets to Crozier and to Boston University, he's saying, "I am going to kill Jim Crow." And he's not arrogant. He doesn't seem like he's got to have the spotlight on him all the time. People described him as humble, warm, a good listener. But he had this sense of confidence that he was meant to do something with his life.
And these big ideas come from a man who, as far as physical stature, is not a big man.
He's 5'6", barefoot. You know, he plays bigger than he looks. He's got this swagger about him. He dresses immaculately. His nickname as a boy is Tweed because he likes to dress like a professor when he's still only a teenager.
While he's in Boston, King Jr. meets Coretta Scott. She's studying music at the New England Conservatory. Jonathan, you came across new writings and I believe audio from Coretta, what do we learn about the activist in her?
I really think that's the key to understanding the relationship. She had more experience as an activist than he did at that point in their lives, because she'd been to Antioch College. She had been involved in protest movements there. And I think King was really attracted to her experience on the ground as an activist. Even though King, as I said, he's a flawed man, one of his big blind spots is he fails to really appreciate the role that women could have played in the civil rights movement and the role Coretta could have played. She's really relegated to taking care of the children far more often than she wants to be.
Let's hear Coretta speaking in the late 70s in an interview that you found for an unpublished biography. In this scratchy audio, she says she could never separate her identity from Martin's.
I've never been able to completely separate myself from Martin. How presumptuous of me, you know.
When Dr. King was in Montgomery, Alabama, he gets his first job as a preacher. And soon after that, there's the famous moment, Rosa Parks not giving up her seat on the public bus. King is a young preacher at the time, rallying people and essentially lifting the veil of racist gaslighting. He affirms all men are created equal.
He's 26 years old. He has a new baby. He's got a new church. When this moment arises, when Rosa Parks won't give up her seat on the bus, suddenly the community is prepared to protest. They're looking for somebody to speak to the crowd that first night. They're waiting to decide what to do. Are we going to stay off the buses for a day, for a week, for how long? King is asked to give the initial speech that night. He has 20 minutes to prepare, has a panic attack. Now he's only got 10 minutes to prepare, and gives one of the greatest speeches in American history because he finds his voice. And that's when he's launched. And it's really a magical moment because he combines the calls for justice with the call to appreciate the words of the Bible, to appreciate the words of the Constitution, and to try to give them the meaning that they have so far been lacking. And that really not just rallies the crowd, but it calls the attention of the nation.
We are not wrong in what we are doing. If we are wrong, the Supreme Court of this nation is wrong. If we are wrong, the Constitution of the United States is wrong. If we are wrong, God Almighty is wrong.
He's steeped in philosophy, in politics, in religion. And the fact that news media is flocking from the North to come cover him really becomes a game changer. He's forcing the nation to ask new questions. And really nobody to that point in that era was really confronting us in that way.
Years later, there's Birmingham, Alabama. Martin Luther King, like many, is arrested and he's isolated in jail. And I want to ask you about his famous letter from a Birmingham jail. It turns out he wrote it on scraps of paper, burger wrappers, toilet paper? That's crazy.
Yeah, he really did. I spoke to the woman who typed that letter on the scraps of paper that were coming out of jail. They were being smuggled out, and Willie Pearl Mackey King was typing them that each night, and she said it was the most disgusting job she ever had, and she didn't save those scraps of paper because they were just nasty. But this is, again, part of King's genius. You know, he'd been prepared for that all his life. The words that he's jotting on the newspaper margins and on the toilet paper and on the sandwich wrappers are words that he's been preaching, words that he's been writing in papers in seminary all his life. And it comes together in this passionate moment when he's furious, not just for being jailed. He's furious because religious leaders, people who should have his back, are in fact saying, you know, just be patient. Your time is coming. We're working on it. Stop demanding so much so soon. And King is infuriated by this. How can you ask us to wait when we've been waiting 300 years? How can you ask us to wait when we are still not being treated as equal citizens in this country? Again, you know, he finds a voice and he finds a way to call upon Americans to reconsider their consciences, really pushes the buttons of even, you know, everyone up to the president who feels like suddenly we have to answer, we have to respond to what King is saying.
When you think about Martin Luther King, the man, what did you learn about him, the man, that you didn't know?
Well, this might sound, I learned a lot of things about him. I learned that he chewed his fingernails. I learned that he used to shout at the TV set when he was watching game shows, that he smoked cigarettes and hid them from his kids. But the most profound thing I learned is that he believed in God in a way that very few of us do. He believed that he had to act on the things that he preached, and that required him to give his life in service. Friends said, you know, you're making things harder on yourself. Just stick to voting rights in the South. Just stick to where you're most effective. He would say, I can't do that. I believe in the words of Jesus. I believe that we have to fight poverty, that we have to fight inequality, that we have to attack militarism and materialism. And the fact that every time he had a moment where he could have stepped back, but he did not, he doubled down, that just came straight from his religious beliefs. And that moved me so much in the years I spent immersed in his life.
Jonathan Eig is author of the new and expansive biography, King, A Life. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you.